Hello, it's Monday the 21st of June, the longest day of the year, and I'm Jim White, sitting in for Andrew Pearce, who's taking a well-earned staycation. And this is the Andrew Pearce Show, coming direct from the Daily Mail newsroom. Will the new hybrid working arrangements that everyone expects to happen post-pandemic mean women end up not being promoted as frequently as men? We'll be finding out. Plus, we'll be hearing the stirring story of what happened to a bunch of stray dogs left abandoned on the streets of Iraq. And what difference does it make to those taking part having a crowd at a sporting event? We'll be speaking to someone who knows. First though, Matt Hancock today confirmed that plans to scrap travel quarantine rules for fully vaccinated Britons may soon come into force, bolstering hopes that summer holidays could yet be on the cards. The Health Secretary said ministers were working on relaxing restrictions for double-jabbed adults, which could see the current mandatory 10-day self-isolation from amber and red list countries replaced with daily COVID tests. With me to discuss the implications of a relaxing of the quarantine rules is Ryan Howsam, founder and chairman of the UK travel insurer Staysure. Ryan, thanks for joining us. Just 89 people out of 23,465 returning from amber list countries over the last fortnight have tested positive. Does that make you think it's okay to relax the rules now?
Well, yeah, I mean, absolutely. I believe they should relax the rules. I mean, we've been the travel industry have been waiting for this for some time, and it's obviously thrown things into chaos. But I think one of the problems now is that, you know, we know that the Europeans are traveling en masse. I think there's potentially going to be a problem with accommodation. You know, you know what it's like in Britain at the moment. I mean, we're seeing huge numbers of people travel in Britain, but, you know, and struggling to get accommodation. And I think there's probably going to be a similar problem in Europe if we don't get on with it fast.
You mean you won't be able to get a hotel room even if you can go abroad?
Well, yeah, I believe that could be a problem. So I think that was reported. But, you know, I know that from my counterparts in other parts of Europe, for example, in Germany, you know, their travel insurance sales there are above 2019 levels. So, you know, and I think, you know, the news that they were putting on 747s to, you know, get people to some of these other European countries. So I'm sure that there will be a tightening of availability for accommodation. Absolutely.
Matt Hancock didn't suggest that any change of policy was imminent, though, did he? When do you think it would need to happen to allow the travel industry to recover?
Yeah, well, it's got to happen now. I mean, it's, you know, if it doesn't happen imminently, I mean, like the next, you know, few days or a week, I just think that this summer's going to be over. I mean, we're the market leader in this area, but the core area that we specialise in is the mature market, and we know that those customers aren't travelling. I mean, when we sent out a survey to them, I think back in April, about 80% of them said they were definitely not going to travel this year. But we are seeing a big resurgence in younger consumers travelling.
That's simply a fear of the risk of travelling, is it, that's putting off older travellers?
It's a bit of an odd one, isn't it, when, you know, they are going to be fully vaccinated. I think it's, you know, when you get to a certain age, there's all the kerfuffle and going on, having to, you know, quarantine, and then on the back of that, you've also got the costs and the messing about with the with the testing, and I think, you know, that you get to a point at a certain age where you say, well, I'll just leave it, I'll ride it out to the next year, and I'll travel in the UK, and that's what our core customers were saying, and that's what's played out. So I think, you know, a big proportion of the travelling consumer public is probably not going to travel this year anyway, from the data that we've got.
With numbers so low, do you think that the travel industry has been wrongly targeted?
Absolutely. I mean, when you look at the impact on the travel industry is huge. I think I think three or four of the big players have been making redundancies at the moment. So, I mean, obviously the government, they've got to protect the consumer. But at the end of the day, either the vaccination program is working or it isn't. I mean, if you look at the, I think it's Germany, we've got more cases but fewer deaths. So clearly the vaccination program is working. You just think the government would actually set out some guidelines that show that that data is playing true and allow people to travel.
Do you know if travellers are strictly adhering to the Amber List rules anyway? Have you got any sense of that? Or are people just going abroad and coming back and carrying on as normal?
Well, we haven't got a sense as to whether they're breaking the quarantine rules. And I think, most people will follow the rules, but we do know that for example, with our policies, and a lot of customers don't realize this, I mean, the fiasco that this traffic light system is with the combination of the SCDO. So you've got the you've got the traffic light system, and then you've got the government don't go to these countries, but it's not illegal to not go. Now, what that does, it invalidates most insurance policies. We're one of the few companies in the UK where you can add on to allow yourself to go and still be covered in Europe, and we've just done a deal for the US as well. So a lot of customers don't realise that. So a lot of people can still travel and can still get insurance to travel, but whether they're following the quarantine rules, I've no idea, but I would think most people would be.
I tell you what, Ryan, I had to go abroad last week for work,
yeah.
And the bureaucracy of it is really daunting. And for one thing, for older travellers, if you haven't got a smartphone, you can't go. You literally, everything is on your blooming smartphone.
Yeah, it's a complete fiasco, this thing. It really is. I mean, how some of these travel companies are going to, get going. I mean, we managed to make a profit last year. This year, it's really tough. And I don't know many companies that can go as, we are now coming up to a year and a half, probably 2 years, with massively depressed income. Not many companies can do that. I think the long-term damage that they've done to the tourism and hospitality industries is beyond repair. But also the stupidity of it. If you've got, for example, this event that we had at the weekend in Cornwall, we weren't allowed to have any spectators. But yet you've had Wembley Stadium, Ascot, and there's another event going on as well. There's just no rhyme or reason to it. It just makes no sense at all. I think that it's a complete shambles.
On a lighter note, Stacia are sponsoring the Legends Golf Tour this summer. Is that going to go ahead as normal, as anticipated?
Yeah. Well, it sponsored last year, and I got involved with it with now what we call the Legends Tour. We actually had the first event in Trevose this weekend, and it had the Ryder Cup captain, Thomas Bjorn, playing major winners. Chris Williams won the event. It was fantastic. So we've finally up and running, and very excited to be part of that.
Oh, many thanks to Ryan Howson, founder and chairman of the UK travel insurer Stayshore. Visit mailplus.co.uk to listen to the Andrew Pearce Show for free and in full, along with all our other podcasts and video series. Remember to tell your Alexa speaker to play Daily Mail News. They were found emaciated and wounded on the streets of Erbil in war-torn Iraq, where summer temperatures regularly hit 50 degrees centigrade and Islamic State bombs are a constant threat. But today, five dogs rescued from this war zone find themselves in altogether more relaxing surroundings after being transported 3,000 miles to the Welsh countryside, where they're looking for new homes. With me to talk about these deserving animals is Louise Hastie, Operations Director and co-founder of War Paws. Louise, you served in Iraq in the logistics corps in the army. I guess kind of animals are the forgotten victims of war. Are there a lot of strays on the streets there?
Sadly, yes, there are a lot of strays, and I obviously became aware of the plight of all these stray animals in Iraq when I was actually serving there as a soldier back in 2004.
And just give us an example of what happened to some of these dogs that you were able to bring to Britain.
Well, some of the dogs such as Rumeya, she was reported to our veterinary clinic at our shelter in Iraq as having something around her neck. When she actually got to the clinic, we saw that she'd actually had a plastic cable tie put around her neck, clearly when she was a young puppy. And as she had grown, the cable tie had just got tighter and tighter and had actually sheared right through her windpipe.
Oh, that's horrible. So what could you do to her there to help her?
Well, the initial thought was that we were actually going to have to euthanise Rumi. You know, it was a pretty horrific injury. And it's like, oh, you know, what should we do? But Romeo actually surprised us all. She was ravenously hungry, very, very happy to see people. So I sat down with the vet team and we discussed the case and we said, okay, you know, she's a happy dog. We're going to give this dog a chance. So we just basically embarked on what turned out to be 8 weeks of extreme wound management.
So she's now living in the Welsh countryside. How on earth did you get her and her four companions over to Britain?
Oh, getting them back to the UK is actually incredibly difficult. Number one, obviously, we have to raise the funds to get them home, which in the case of these dogs, we partnered with Many Tears Animal Rescue in Wales, and they actually raised the funds to bring them home. And then once that's all sorted out, the dogs have to go through an incredibly long and arduous process to become legal to enter the UK. We have to microchip them. We have to give them a rabies vaccine. Then we have to give them a blood test. And then they have to remain in the country of origin for 3 months after the blood test. And then once all that waiting time is out of the way, then we have to sort of start to look at how we're going to get them home, which has not been easy, mainly because of COVID and shutting down of airlines and the various routes that we would normally use.
And now they're here, are they in demand as pets?
They are. We are being inundated with people calling and emailing asking, you know, can I give this dog a home? Can I give this dog a home? You know, one of the things that we have seen during COVID is the massive increase in the amount of people that want to offer a dog a home.
And if someone's interested in adopting one of these dogs or just helping your charity, how do they get in touch?
If there are people out there that would like to adopt one of the dogs, they would need to actually head to manytearsrescue.org, which is the website for Many Tears Animal Rescue. As they raise all the funds for the dogs, they're actually going to be handling the rehoming process. And obviously, if anybody wants to help us sort of bring more dogs home, help us support the 300-plus dogs we're caring for at the shelter in Iraq, they just need to head over to warpaws.org.
And Louise, are you going to go back to Iraq soon to help bring some more of those 300 to Britain?
I certainly hope so. Again, COVID has sort of paid for that for the last 12 months or so. But prior to that, I was aiming to sort of do 3 or 4 trips a year over to Iraq to go and spend time working at the shelter and identifying dogs that we felt would thrive in the UK as opposed to being kept at the shelter.
Oh, well, many thanks to Louise Hasty there, Operations Director and co-founder of War Paws. A permanent switch to increased home working after the pandemic could result in more gender inequality, experts have warned. As the end of COVID restrictions get closer, bosses are considering whether to bring back employees full-time or to move forward with a hybrid model that would see employees split their time between the office and home. But employment experts have warned that a hybrid model could impact gender equality in the workplace. Joining me to discuss why that might be is Jolie Brearley, author and founder of Pregnant Then Screwed. Jolie, why is it you think or you fear that women will be disproportionately badly affected by this kind of flexible return to work?
So I don't necessarily think they will inevitably be disproportionately affected, but I think there's some warning signs, and we need to be very careful that this could create new inequalities in the workplace. Because what will happen if companies move to a more blended form of working, which is what lots of companies are talking about, where employees can either work at home or they can go into the office if they choose, is that mothers will work at home so that they can do the drop-offs, they can do the pickups, they can be available if their child gets sick, they can clean up the breakfast mess after it's been made and put the washing on. And disabled people will work at home because it's much easier rather than doing the commute into work. And other employees will go into the office. And that means that those in the office will have more access to management. They will build better relationships with their employer. They'll be standing around the water cooler and having really good conversations with colleagues that will give them new information that they might need to be promoted. They will be the ones that look like they're committed. They will be the ones that are better known to the people that can promote them. And so ultimately, what we will end up with is the people in the office who are more likely to be men, they're more likely to not be disabled, they will end up getting promoted and they will end up getting the accolade for the work that they're doing, whereas the mothers at home and the disabled people sadly will fall behind.
Now, there's a hint in the title of your organisation, Pregnant Then Screwed, that this happens a lot, does it, to women who take maternity leave. Is that a common happening for that?
Well, so, yeah, I mean, what obviously the way that the law is set up, it encourages women to take time out after children are born more than it does men. Women get maternity leave. It's paid for 6 weeks at 90% of their salary, and then it drops down to statutory, whereas men don't get that first 6 weeks at 90%, and actually men are more likely to earn more. So it's usually the women that sacrifice their careers and take that first year out of the workplace. And then because they're out of work, they're seen as not committed to their jobs. So when they return, the workplace, you know, may have moved on, and they have sort of sidelined them. And it takes women a really long time once they get back into the workplace to be seen as promotable. And it really sets their careers back by quite some way, even though they've only been actually been out of work for maybe 9 months, perhaps a year.
That said though, Julie, for a lot of people who have families, actually a flexible way of working is more appropriate to their lifestyle, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's impossible to have a child at school. They've got to be at school for 9 a.m. You've got to pick them up at 3:30 at the latest, and most working workplaces are from 9 till 5. You know, it doesn't add up. You need some flexibility in order to have a family, and we know that workplaces that are more flexible are more productive. And actually, we have a real issue in the UK with presenteeism. In 2009 we were crowned the unpaid 2019 sorry we were crowned the unpaid overtime capital of Europe. We work ridiculous hours, and our productivity in this country is incredibly low. So flexible working practices are a really, really positive thing. But actually what we're seeing at Pregnant Then Screwed is because more people are now working at home, employers are not granting other types of flexible working, which are actually far more helpful for parents. So things like reduced hours, being able to be more flexible with time, so perhaps starting later or perhaps finishing earlier so that you can do those drop-offs and pickups. Those types of flexible working requests are being rejected, but home working is being accepted. But that's not reducing the overall number of hours that people are working. In fact, we've seen that the number of hours that people are working has increased during the pandemic. It was an average of 9 hours a day. It's now an average of 11 hours a day that people are working, which is just completely impossible, and means that people are just unable to manage their professional and personal obligations when you're working those sorts of hours.
But this sounds like a philosophical problem. It's a problem with the way that we conduct ourselves at the office. It's a problem of being there and or not being there. What practical solutions do you have in mind to solve this?
I mean, I just think that we need employers to be really aware that this could be a problem. They need data. They need to be analysing this. It's not about just saying that homeworking could be bad, so let's not bother doing it. We know that lots of employees want to work from home, particularly mothers. So absolutely, it should be encouraged, but employees must be aware that it could create these new inequalities. So we want them to collect data, to collect the right data, to analyse that data, and to make sure that they're not sidelining anybody. There's no malice intended here. It's just kind of an accidental outcome of these new ways of working. And if there's one thing that's for sure, COVID-19 has absolutely changed the way that we all live and work. And so this is completely new territory to all of us. And we have to be aware that as well as the positives, there will be some negatives.
Julie, as a final thought, it is very unlikely that I'll ever be in a position to employ anybody. But give me a word of advice. If I am, what should I do?
You need to be very careful that there's no bias in the recruitment process. So we think that actually blind recruitment is really positive, not see people when you're interviewing them. That really works. Pay them properly. Make sure you give them really good flexible working terms and really good holiday. And just really look after your staff, because your staff are your company.
Brilliant advice. Thanks so much. That was Jolie Brearley, founder and CEO of Pregnant Then Screwed. It's been a very busy sporting weekend, so let's hear now from Matt Gatwood, deputy sports editor at the Daily Mail. Matt, now, all the social media bosses have been saying that the one thing that Gareth Southgate's got to do is drop Harry Kane, but he said he's not going to. What do you reckon?
No, he's definitely not. He's actually admitted he doesn't normally give any details about his team away ahead of games. But obviously, England play the Czech Republic in their final group game tomorrow. And Southgate has already said that Harry Kane will definitely start. There's been a bit of chat around him. Obviously, he hasn't had a shot on target. He hasn't looked himself in the first two games. If I'm honest, he hasn't kind of pulled up any trees. His movement has not been kind of as we'd expect. And, he is one of the world's best strikers, if not the best. So you obviously would expect him to be terrorising defences, and he isn't doing that. Would I have played him, though? Of course. As I said, he's one of the world's best strikers, so of course you play him, and of course you hope he comes good. England need him to. Obviously, they've only scored one goal so far in two games, so they definitely need their key striker to start hitting the target. Hopefully that starts tomorrow night.
Now, one home nation has qualified already. Wales, by the skin of their teeth, got through. Great performance, though. Down to 10 men?
Yeah, they did well. They dug in. They were down to 10 men against Italy, who are surprising people. They're surprising me, anyway, in terms of just how good they are. I know they've been on a very good run coming into the Euros, but they won all three games. But Italy hung on, got the points they needed. It was dicey, though, because it was going to come down to, it did come down to goal difference. So they didn't need Italy to run riot and score lots of goals past them, because that would have meant they'd have swapped places with Switzerland and finished in third. And then they'd have had a nervy wait about whether they'd have qualified for the next stage. As it was, they managed to hang on to a 1-0 defeat, which obviously is a defeat, but felt like a victory. As you say, they were down to 10 men. So they can be very proud. They're through. They've actually got their game is in Amsterdam on Saturday, so they'll be looking forward to that one. They don't quite know who they've got yet, but they have got a reasonably favourable draw, unlike England might have if England were to win the group. So Wales can be confident, quietly confident of going a little bit further still.
And when, of course, they play Italy, we see on the touchline the man who I think we can all agree is the coolest manager in international football, Roberto Mancini.
You're right. He is pretty cool. There's a few cool managers around, though. I kind of think Luis Enrique, the Spanish manager, is quite cool as well. So I'd put those two up there vying for the coolest manager in the tournament. But you're right, Mancini does look pretty cool most of the time.
Yeah, he dresses very stylishly as well.
He's
come
very
on,
snappy
you've
dresser.
Got, you've got to admit that, Matt.
I admit that. I like Enrique's style as well. So, I think those two could have a fashion off to see who wins.
So that's the final, Italy against Spain in the cool stakes. And talking of Spain, Spain's Jon Rahm won the US Open Golf, his first major. Now, he's a big lad, isn't he? Is he the shape of things to come as the muscle men take over golf?
Well, yeah, you'd think so. I mean, he is a big unit, you're right, and he can certainly whack a ball. Obviously, there's been a lot of chat over the last few years about players like Brooks Koepka, who is a very big, strong, powerful golfer as well, and Bryson DeChambeau, of course, who has intentionally made himself bigger so he can hit the ball further and further. And those two were in the mix as well at Torrey Pines, where, you're right, Rahm won his first major. And it's been a tight, you know, I think everyone thought it was a matter of when, not if, for Rahm. And it was brilliant. His celebrations of the only sadness was he finished early. So he kind of finished, posted his score, and then Louis Oosthuizen couldn't match it. So we saw some great celebrations from him, but he was celebrating even before he knew he'd won it, if you know what I mean. But yeah, it could be. But, you know, then you've only got to look back at the previous major, which was won by Phil Mickelson. And he's a very artful golfer. So there's room probably in the golfing landscape for all sorts of players of all sizes and all shapes and all abilities. So, yeah, it's a sign that, you know, hitting it a long way helps. But lefty Mickelson in the last tournament showed there's still room for the more considered golfer, shall we say.
The considered golfer of a slightly more comfortable shape. So there's good news for all of us then.
Indeed. Indeed. Yeah, certainly for me.
Thanks, Matt. Well, the biggest sporting event of the summer will be the Tokyo Olympics. And the authorities there have just announced that local fans will be able to attend after all. 20,000 people will be allowed into the opening ceremony, with up to 10,000 at individual events. But COVID restrictions mean they will be banned from singing, shouting, or hugging their neighbour in celebration. So what difference will it make to the competitors playing in front of silent spectators? Let's talk to someone who knows what it's like to step out into an Olympic arena. Gail Emms, who won the silver medal in the badminton at Athens in 2004. Gail, what was it like stepping out into that arena? I mean, do the hairs on the back of your neck stand up at the sound?
Oh my goodness, yes. It's going to be some of those moments in my life that I will never, ever forget. And it's also really hard to describe, because how do you describe a feeling? How do you describe, other than the fact that I just got goosebumps everywhere? And I just remember walking out and, you know, my mind was going crazy with all tactics and, you know, nerves, you know, my stomach was all over the place. And then I just remember that I walked out and all I could hear were chants of Barmy Army. And I just remember thinking, what's going on here? Spamerton, people, what? And that is what I will remember for the rest of my life. There were people with flags screaming. They'd never watched badminton before. They didn't care. It was a fact. It was a British sporting crowd, and they were there to give every ounce of support they could. And that is something that you cannot ever replace or describe. It is just true sporting wonderment.
Could you pick out individual things? I mean, could you hear anyone shouting out your name or anything?
Yes. You know, there's always one voice you can always hear, no matter how old you are or what the occasion, and that's your mum, isn't it? It's like a homing signal, you know. My mum's from Bedford, a North London girl, and all I hear was, go Gail, go Gail, and, you know, this voice, and I'm just like, oh my God, you know, you're trying to concentrate, and, you know, like I say, you've got nerves going on, you've got tactics, strategies, everything, and all you can hear is your mum's voice, and it's just this brilliant, you're kind of annoyed. You're like, oh my God, shut up, woman. You know, that's part of you saying that because, you know, you don't want to be put off by your mum, and you're supposed to be an adult and all that, and you're supposed to be an Olympic athlete. But at the same time, what a lovely reassurance. You know, the person that started me off on my badminton journey is that person I can still hear, and she's there, and I can hear her, and I know it'll be all right because my mum's in the crowd and my mum is there. And that is something, again, it's just, yeah, it's like the full circle. You know, my mum was there when I first held that badminton racket and that shuttle and tried to hit, you know, and tried to play. And now she's here watching me in an Olympic final.
That's the sadness for your successors, because although there are going to be fans in the arena, they're going to be local fans because of the pandemic. relatives, friends, partners aren't going to be able to be there. No. That's a huge miss for the British team, isn't it?
It's horrible. It really upsets me, because you give back. You know, that's why you play sport. You show off. You show how good you've got. You show how hard you've worked. You show off your training. You show off that dedication. You show off that, you know, all those people believed you. You're showing off what they've done for you. It give back. And you can't do that in this situation at the moment. And yeah, you are, I guess you're on TV, but it's not the same. You feel it. You feel the crowd. You feel that energy. It gives you that boost. It makes you move faster. It makes you more alert. It makes you that adrenaline rush, that, you know, even more. That's what a crowd does for you. And it makes it more emotional. It's sterile playing in front of no one. It's sterile playing in front of people who really don't know who you are and don't give one either. It's not sport. Sport is where you have your fans there who appreciate you, who are your supporters. You know, whether they know your sport or not, but they're from your country, that is what sport's about.
Yeah, because the crowd there, I believe, they're being banned from shouting. They can't even cheer. It's going to be very eerie, isn't it? Sort of 10,000 people sitting in the stands in silence.
What, just staring at you? That's going to be freaky more than anything. I'd rather have cardboard cutouts, you know, or nothing. You know, it's just, what's the point of people staring at you that can't cheer? That's just going to be like, you hit a good shot and look to the crowd for some appreciation. They're just going to be like, you know, how are they going to be able to do it? I don't know, because I won't be able to watch sport without cheering or clapping or anything like that. That's part of it. You get excited watching sport. So how the crowds are going to sit there and not do anything, I don't know either. It's just, everyone's going to feel awkward and on edge, aren't they? It's just, you know, no one's really know what to do. And again, that's not a sporting place. That's not a sporting arena. That's not, yeah, it's not what it should be, is it?
It isn't, I'm afraid, Gail. And it's not what it should be, because you won't be there, though you are still playing, aren't you?
Yes, I'm actually on court today. I'm actually teaching PE teachers how to teach badminton in schools, which is really good fun. I think, you know, one of my passions is obviously to get badminton played as much as possible to inspire many kids and everything. So the badminton teachers, I don't think they're going to be able to walk tomorrow. I really think I've you know, got some of them moving around the court that they didn't think that badminton could be played like badminton, how I've just shown them. So I think there's going to be a few sore legs and sore bombs tomorrow. But yeah, that's brilliant.
Brilliant. Thank you so much for speaking to us, Gail. And I hope that one of these teachers is going to inspire the next Gail Ems. You never know.
You never know, me too. But yeah, the main thing is we get these kids active and we get them inspired by sport. And even if we're showing the Olympics on TV with no crowds and no noise, at least it's something anyway.
That's brilliant. Thanks so much, Gail. That's all we have time for today. For the latest from the Daily Mail, download the Mail Plus app. Every day this week at 5 p.m, you can listen to me all over again. I'm Jim White, sitting in for the incomparable Andrew Pearce, and I'll be back tomorrow. Have yourselves a great evening. Good night.